I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Welcome, all of you, to Rag Radio once more. We come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. In Austin, Texas, and around the world. How about? We originate on Co-op, which is a Co-op 91.7 FM, KOOP.org in Austin, Texas. It's a all-volunteer, solar-powered, collectively run community radio station. So how about that? And we're rebroadcast on a number of other stations around the country, and our podcasts go out and are on a number of platforms. So we have folks all over the place listening to us. So that's cool. I want to, our regular crew is here. Tracy Schultz is our engineer and co-producer. Tracy, how are you?
Oh, doing well. Thank you.
Everything. It's been freezing here.
It's been a little cold. It's now hot.
Yeah, I mean, it's hot. It's in the 50s.
Hot-ish, yeah, comparatively.
But I mean, we've had a couple of days where it didn't even get above freezing the whole day. And for us, for Austin, Texas, if you're up somewhere else, I just saw that I forget, in Florida, I think it was, that iguanas were falling, iguana icicles were falling from trees, and yeah. I mean, terrible stuff.
They get stunned by the cold, and then they just kind of fall out of the sky.
Yeah. And you got to stay away, because if that's an icicle, it could kind of go right to you. So, and then I hope people are trying to warm them up and help them survive. I don't know if that's still possible. I don't know too much about iguana medicine. Great show today. We have an all-star cast. In addition to Tracy, Susie Sheeler, who's been our apprentice, but who's graduating, and she will stay with us, and we're going to call her a Rag Radio Associate.
I'm very excited about that. Thank you very much.
Well, and we're very excited to have you continue with us. Roger Baker is here taking pictures, as always. So, all-star cast, Roy Casagrande is here in the studio. Roy is a professor of government, not an associate professor, but a professor of government at Austin Community College, where he teaches U.S. and Texas politics. His areas of research include Middle East history and politics, U.S. foreign policy, political philosophy, and warfare. Casagrande serves as an analyst on Middle East political affairs. Do you still do this? For
yes.
The Austin ABC affiliate KVUE. Glenn Smith, who's our normal, regular Dreyer accomplice when it comes to political analysis, is also with us. He's with us on the phone. Noted strategist and Rag Radio political analyst, the director of Progress Texas PAC. Glenn is an op-ed columnist for the Austin American Statesman, a columnist for the Quorum Report, and a former political reporter for the Houston Chronicle and Houston Post. And we should note that Glenn managed Ann Richards' winning 1990 Texas gubernatorial campaign. Glenn, are you there?
I'm there, and I was really young then, and two, when Sheila has her own show, I want to put my bid in now to be on it regularly.
Okay.
Your
bid is in. So, and she will have one. That's coming up.
Excellent.
All right. This is going to be fun. Topics that we may talk about. How big really is Donald Trump's button? I guess, you know, I don't know. That's just a very large hypothetical.
And can he find it?
And can he find it? That's the other question. We want to talk about politics, and there's so much going on that, you know, we can barely touch the surface on it. But we want to talk about Michael Wolff's blockbuster book on Donald Trump and the reactions to it and its likely effect on Trump's future. And then we're also there's a book that Roy wants to talk about, and I thought it would be fun to have the tale of two books. What is that book, Roy? Tell us.
The Politics That Presidents Make by Stephen Skoronek.
And it kind of creates a model for how, tell us what it does, and we'll get to it in a minute. We're going to talk first about the current stuff.
But. So it's really quite amazing, because what Skoronek notices is that there's a pattern in presidential history. If you want, you could imagine a sine wave with, you know, crests and troughs. The troughs are political crises, and then what happens in between those political crises is that one political party just dominates the presidency.
Okay.
And so you'll have like whole periods of time where it'll just be Democrat, 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 and then Republican, then Democrat, Democrat, Republican. And what
Well, don't go into the whole thing, but basically what we're going to do is we're going to see how the Trump presidency fits into that model, I guess, in some ways, or does it, or if it's a whole departure. Anyway, so that's some of what we're going to talk about. I can't help but note what a weird, weird world we live in, and I think everybody's pretty aware of that. But if you just look at the top of the news, I mean, I was just reading today, socialite Jacqueline Kent Cook, who's the daughter of former Washington Redskins owner Jack Kent Cook, was just charged with assault with a $300 glass purse. She was arrested Wednesday after a New Year's Eve altercation that allegedly involved this $300 glass clutch and an anti-Semitic slur. They're charging her with second-degree assault. And it seems like there's a lot of sort of right-wing assault going on in our society. And, of course, the thing that I especially noted today was it was in a Washington Post story today. If folks don't know who the Mercers are, they probably have played a somewhat behind the scenes but incredibly important role in the development of the alt-right in this country. Robert Mercer today said, or he's quoted in the Washington Post today as saying, and he's a mega donor, he said that he believes that human beings have no inherent value other than how much money they make. This was not his words. This was a colleague of his who told the New Yorker this. He believes that human beings have no inherent value other than how much money they make. If someone is on welfare, they have negative value. If he earns 1,000 times more than a school teacher, then he's 1,000 times more valuable. So that's what we're looking at.
Very Calvinist.
Yeah. So I just want you guys to take off from there on what's happening right now. What does it mean? What happens? Is Trump in serious danger? What is going to happen with Bannon? Is this divorce for real? And what does this mean to that alt-right movement, to the insurrectionist right wing looking towards the 2018 elections? Just, it's an open field. Glenn, why don't you start?
Sure, thank you. First I want to give you, I mentioned something about the assault that you talked about rising. My first encounter with the real world outside my home on New Year's Day, I'm on the freeway here in Austin. An elderly couple's in front of me. A young man in a little pickup is very impatient, and he cuts in front of that older couple and almost hits them. So they beep their horn. He got rocks out of the cab and threw them out his driver's side window at their windshield before speeding off. And I just took that as a sign of the times to get really local on you. Quickly, then, about the book and Trump. One of the things that I've noticed is, what's kind of surprising, is some skeptical looks from the East Coast media, mainstream media, about some of the details in the book. But it's surprising because the general themes and descriptions of where the Trump White House is, it just corroborates what other reporters have been writing about for months. So I'm not sure what that quibbling with this detail or about who said what, sure where that's coming from. The overall picture is god-awful. The additional comment I would make is that for Bannon, it was like he was applying to go to a grand jury with his comments. And I'm sure he'll be in front of one before he knows it. And I'm not sure why he did that.
Yeah, I mean, it partly is that it seems like Bannon and Trump were sort of a marriage made in heaven, because they both have this sort of instinctive way of just going bananas, illogically, you never know what either of them will say. Somehow there's a similar temperament there, I think.
Yeah, don't let them together over really warm Gulf water. We'll have another hurricane, right? they feed one another in a way that's destructive to the country and to all of us, or potentially destructive.
What do you think, both of you, this book, of course, I don't know. I've seen a lot of analysis of it on cable television, and all of the news people that they have, and the political analysts, everybody seems to say, well, whatever quibbles there might be with some of the specifics, that it just reads true in terms of their perceptions of what's happening in the White House. But the most interesting thing is where there is the extent to which they've said what I think most of us have perceived for a long time, is that that they treat Trump like he's a child, and that they see him as semi-illiterate. And this whole thing about having lost a step when he didn't really have a whole lot of steps to lose.
Well, for myself, it's telling about his reaction. It's like Trump's reaction and the administration reaction, at least in public, for a book that nobody has been able to read except for leaks up until just recently. It's kind of telling more, it's like, to the story than, and if they just said, it's like, yeah, we're not going to pay any attention to it.
Well, yeah, but they don't, they can't, he can't ever do that. He's incapable of not paying attention to it.
Perception, his own self-perception matters a lot.
Roy?
Well, I'm really curious to see what happens to him in the polls. So, you know, so far, since we've been keeping track of polls in large measure since 1948, he's been doing worse than any president that we've had. He started off barely, I think he was 47% on Inauguration Day. I think he may have reached 50%. And then he pretty rapidly fell down into the 40 range and has slowly been working his way down. He got down to about 36%, and he's actually back up to 38%. And so it seems like no matter what happens, his low is 36, and no matter what happens, his high is about 38. It'll take a while, of course, for this book to have effect, but it'll be interesting to see if it shakes off some people from the 36%, or if he somehow manages to even move up, which wouldn't surprise me too much, because it seems like no matter what he does, what he says, what he tweets, he's going to always be right around 36 to 38%.
Do you think, Glenn, do you think that what he does, do you because he's done so much, I mean, he's that... is totally incompatible with the stuff he promised. The tax bill, of course, is the most famous, but I mean, all the way across the board. How much do you think that core base? How big is the core base, and what's going to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I really think there's two things going on. I do think he has a sort of they'll never shake off of him base of around 20 to 25%. And they love him because he beats up people they hate and want to see beaten up. But that other 10 to 15%, say from 25 to 40, I think that's an artifact of polling, frankly. I think that they're just used to saying they're for the Republican. They're probably pretty stout Republicans, but they don't really like Trump. But they're just not going to bring themselves to say anything, but I'm for the Republican. And this happens, we see it in polling, in national polling, about incumbent presidents all the time. It's hard to shake them further than that. There's a rule of thumb, Roy may know of it, where if he falls below 80 with his own voters, he's in serious trouble. And he's hovered right around that, really, with just his base, his own voters. So he's pretty marginal as far as another national election goes at the moment. And I think that's because of his behavior as president, period.
What about the Republican Party as a whole? You know, I mean, it seems like there's more, it's split more, and there's more squabbles within. And it looks like that Bannon's, assuming Bannon remains persona non grata and loses the money, the big money that he had, both for Breitbart and for his for funding, insurgent candidacies. Is that help the Republicans because they won't have to have idiots running? That, I mean,
yeah. Let me say really quick. One thing about Bannon that would justify what he said is that he's waking up and seeing that Trump's button, oh, I'm sorry, I mean base, is smaller than he wants to believe. All right? So Bannon is seeing that he can't get where he wants to go relying on that base, so a little antagonism between him and Trump may actually help him. He may be making that calculation.
That's interesting. That's the first I've heard of that suggestion. But you know what? It's also unpredictable. And, of course, the Trump it falls out with everybody, and suddenly they're back in favor, and they might find that they need to work together again. But your point is well taken, and if it's the battle of the buttons, who knows? So size matters? I don't know. So, okay, Let's talk a little bit. Well, do you have anything more to add at that point? Because I want to go into this, Roy's, the book we were talking about.
No, I think that's interesting. Let's go. Let's go.
All right. So lay a premise. Lay
okay.
It out.
So
Roy Casagrande.
So here's what happens. There's a national crisis. The crisis can be big. It could be something like the Civil War or the Great Depression. Or it could be a series of things just sort of coming together. So Jimmy Carter represents that crisis, the most recent one of those, where it wasn't one specific thing, but a series of things layered on top of each other. And then what happens is the president we elect after the crisis gets a mandate to do major changes. So think of FDR, think of Ronald Reagan, think of Abraham Lincoln. And then we go through this period of time where we're, at least initially, the country is really in love with those major changes. We call that president the innovator president. We put them on our money. We're so excited about them. It's very hard to criticize them. And so if you think of the sine wave, that's at the trough, at the front end of the sine wave. And then the regime sort of crests and then goes into decline. It fails to fulfill its promises, which is inevitable because we're humans and we're deeply flawed. Or it falls out of line with what the public thinks, or it doesn't keep up with change. And so as a result, we end up in another crisis, and then there's another regime change. And the president at the end is the disjunction president. So the disjunction president is, you know, sticks to the base, sticks to his original regime's ideas, like, you know, in this case, cutting taxes, small government. But one of the ways you can tell that you're a disjunction president is the policies you keep pushing through are wildly unpopular. So if you think of the repeal of Obamacare, that was the second least popular piece of legislation that Congress has considered in a quarter of a century. And then if you consider the tax bill, that was the least popular in a quarter of a century. And so, you know, the hallmarks of the Trump administration look like they've got this disjunction thing going. Disjunctions, no matter how hard they try, they never really pull things off the way they expect to. And in the end, we deride them and we belittle them. You just think of Jimmy Carter here. No matter how good or how bad of a president he was, we always think of him as not a very good president. He didn't know how to do it. Jimmy Carter got no pieces of legislation through in his first 100 days, even though he owned both houses of Congress. Donald Trump didn't get any pieces of legislation through in his first 100 days, even though he owned both houses of Congress. And so it looks like there's this out-of-touch guy who's trying to hold on to the regime's old ideology, but the American public has moved on.
Okay, Glenn.
Fascinating.
Hello?
I wonder if the sine wave is changeable by external events. So in other words, is alterable, or is it sort of a more determinist view that has to do with a lot of external circumstances that are waves that presidents and their timing just ride like surfers?
So I think
deterministic way.
I totally think it's the former. So you know, there's an argument that could be made that the almost election of Al Gore might have initiated the end of the conservative regime, and then the election of Barack Obama in 2008. If you had had this conversation with me, I was sure that was the end of the conservative regime. That, you know, Reaganomics was rejected by not only giving the presidency to Obama, but giving him a filibuster-proof Senate. But it seems to me that events, for example, the cheating in Florida, or maybe the color of Obama's skin, did actually alter the model, and that we appear to be susceptible to the regime ending later. Like, you can postpone it, you can put it off.
We could certainly say that I would think that Obama and Trump have one similarity in that there were factors other than the traditional that came to play. And Obama, because he was a black man,
right, and
because of all of the racism, the nascent racism that suddenly started emerging, come to the surface, which you could say actually perhaps fed what's happening now. With Trump's, with the national ultra-nationalism and whatever with Trump. And that Trump, of course, also is unique and maybe doesn't fit patterns because of the narcissism, because of the fact that he's just a product of his own mind, in a sense.
Yeah, and I think also 9/11 played a big role in all of this, and not only in fueling our ultranationalism, but also in taking this really illegitimate president of Junior and making him, in people's minds, a legitimate president. He ended up getting the highest ever approval rating of any president in our history, and then one of the lowest ever approval ratings, giving him the record for having the biggest drop in approval ratings in U.S. history.
Well, and then the question is, have we just been on our way one step at a time to a national nervous breakdown? On that thought, we need to take a break. I'm Thorne Dreyer. My guests are Roy Casagrande and Glenn Smith. Tracy Schultz.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me, sister, with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see. Sister, oh, what's going on?
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio, and we're back with you. My guests are Roy Casagrande and Glenn Smith, who is with us over the telephone, and Roy is sitting right here in the studio. Susie Sheeler, who's our associate, actually has a question that she would like to ask at this point related to what we've been discussing.
Yeah, I was wondering, a lot of my friends, and I've seen a lot of it on social media as well, we're wondering, is it time for the Democrats to take the gloves off and start fighting dirty, or do we continue to take the high road and hope that good wins and evil loses?
What would that look like? What would taking the gloves off and fighting dirty, what would that mean?
Well, I mean, we see, you know, we see the Republicans just kind of stepping back and letting Trump do what he wants to do and not standing up for what we believe is the right thing to do, which is the tax reform bill. You know, a lot of them said, we're not going to sign it if you do this and this, and then they backed down.
I think what we see there is a political party that will be marked, if by nothing else, by its historic level of cowardice
and party over country, for sure.
You know, yeah, and party over principle, party yes. over principle. So,
well, I mean, the thing that comes to my mind as this high road versus the playing dirty is what David Frum, who you know was part of the Bush Jr. administration, said was the weirdest thing from 2017, which was that the same people who almost shot up a pizzeria over a fake child molestation scandal were the people who backed Roy Moore. I think that the contradictions inherent in what is now 37 years of Reagan-style Republican conservatism, those contradictions, I think, are finally kind of being displayed for the whole world, and I don't think anybody has to play dirty anymore. I mean, I think the fact that Doug Jones won in Alabama shows that it's possible for the Democrats not to be the big hypocrites and possibly at least pull off wins. What I'd really like to see happen is for an actual left to form within the Democratic Party, as opposed to having it be a moderate right wing party.
Yeah, and do you think, Glenn, do you think that's actually happening?
I think it's definitely happening. I think the Democrats are being forced in that direction more and more by the excessive policies of the right, if nothing else. I mean, they're destroying the social safety net. So Democrats who wanted to campaign taking advantage of that and not feeling like they have to defend it so they could be more centrist and talk more about Wall Street than Main Street, all of a sudden they're going to have to defend Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, et cetera. So that's going to necessarily move them to the left. I also want to say on that question, which is a good question, chaos is not the friend of the left necessarily. You know, as we've spoken about before, the social safety net was very consciously created in Western Europe after World War II, not because they all woke up compassionate one day wanting to help their fellow man, but because they understood that if they're going to keep the Mussolini and Hitler types at bay, they were going to have to diminish the fear and the potential for fear, uncertainty, and dread amongst the populace. So they created the social safety net. It's not lost on the right that they can destroy it, and maybe the benefits of that destruction accrue to them. And if we feed the fear of that, we may push voters that way. So there's a medium point where we've got to go, where we are addressing the fear and promising to solve the concerns without adding to the kind of nasty uncertainty that the right wants to create among voters.
Okay, Roger, did you put your headphones on because you wanted to say something? Or are you just listening?
I just want to be able to hear what's being
said. Okay, all right, because Roger is often willing to step in and talk for, like, you know, 15 minutes or something. So so if you were always willing to have Roger and Susie and whoever speak up. Tracy, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. No, but you bring up a good point, Glenn, about balance and all.
I think that there's another whole factor, though, and I keep seeing, you know, as I see Trump as being something that's outside the curve or whatever, I think that the issue with fact and truth, which has really fueled the not just the alt-right, but it's become mainstream, and this whole thing about fake news and the fact that, and the anti-science sentiment and the climate change denial. But it's just, it seems to be so rooted now, and the role of social media in enhancing that problem, that seems to be new to me. Glenn?
Well, it's not really new. Let's use the issue of the environment as an example. You know, recently I was in New York doing some training on framing with a national environmental journalist. In fact, actually some are from Europe. And what I'm seeing is that the success of the framing from the right on, say, the climate crisis has hurt the morale of the journalists who see that framing effort having much more effect in the marketplace of ideas than their own work. And I fear that is a little picture. Well, it's a critical picture, but it's a little picture of what's happened to us overall, which, yes, this nutty lies that nobody could possibly believe get identified as lies, but they're having this demoralizing effect on people who are just going, I speak the truth and I don't get this attention. Why bother? I fear that diminishing the efforts from the left and even the center in fighting back against this.
You do see that fatigue in the way people have been responding, and it's also kind of frustrating because I always thought, like, land conservation would be a conservative tentpole issue because you're talking about public lands, like, for the people and things like that. It's like, you also always hear, it's like nowadays, it's like about energy dominance, and it's like about how we need to drill in the Arctic.
You would have also thought that states' rights and local autonomy issues and stuff, aren't those traditional Republican issues? And yet, you know what? Now we have the Justice Department that it's going to theoretically counteract the states that have legalized marijuana, even medical marijuana. You know, we have things like happened here in Texas where suddenly, you know, the local municipalities can pass rules, pass legislation, or pass and the state just overturns it and decides, no, in this case, you know, there is no local autonomy. That's another contradiction. It just seems like there's so many things that don't fit the traditional patterns.
And to sort of jump off of that, Trump himself doesn't fit the traditional pattern, because here he is, a guy who, you know, we all suspected didn't run because he thought he could win, but ran because it was a publicity stunt. And then, you know, it turns out that that's probably the truth. And so we have this a presidency that's a publicity stunt. The whole presidency is a joke. The fact that he doesn't appoint people to top positions within the bureaucracy, you know, the fact that when a president gets elected within a day, the president-elect sends out his team to the White House to start getting briefings on how to switch over the bureaucracy, how to make the transition for the cabinet. He starts picking a White House staff. The Trump administration, 6 months into the presidency, still hadn't done this. This is turned into a giant mockery of the political system. The fact that there's actually a group of people who think this is reasonable, that this is the way to do things, they want to tear down the deep state, for example, shows that this is not politics as usual. This is the kind of nihilistic destruction, my side overall, my side over the truth, who cares about the truth, that I think we saw in the 1930s, which is why there are probably some people, at least, who are really frightened and alarmed by all of this.
Boy, and I think you said something earlier which I think is true, that the contradictions of the right that, you know, were first given bold presentation in the Reagan years, I think they're much more visible. It's as though the Republican Party was like running into the future, disrobing as they went, and now they're the naked authoritarians they always were, right? And it's just that they hid behind the language of freedom and individuality and libertarianism. But the truth is, they're extraordinarily authoritarian, and they have all been all along. It's just that they've been able to hide it behind the flowery, you know, compassionate conservative or a thousand points of light rhetoric that we got from the Bush family, for instance. I think that's a salient point you made that we need to keep in mind.
Yeah, and also when you talk about throwing off the clothing, I think we have a president who very quickly the public is realizing that this emperor has no clothes. So, you know, it's a thing. Okay, I want to ask you guys, and there's some other specific topics I want to talk about, but what does this all tell us about what's going to happen in 2018 and in the future? Right now, projection.
Well, so if the Skowronek model is right, and then to jump onto it, my interpretation is right, that Trump is a disjunction, then what we should see happen is the Democrats should do very well in the congressional elections in 2018, and then they will win the 2020 election, and they will have control of both houses, and in such a way that they will have a mandate to do major changes. So, which is why I said earlier, it'd be nice to see an actual left form and push the Democratic Party in that direction. Having said that, the Democrats are going to have a hard time capturing the Senate. They could. It's possible. It's just the math is stacked against them. If I remember correctly, there's 26 Democratic seats up for election and 8 Republican seats. So, you know, the Democrats have to capture, well, now with the Alabama seat, there's they're going to have to capture 3 to retake control, but a net of 3. So they can't really lose too many of their 26, and they don't have many to capture. And they have to retain that Alabama seat. Having said that, right now they're polling somewhere between 11 and 12% ahead for the congressional race in 2018. That's actually quite remarkable. In 2006, when the Democrats took both houses of Congress, they were 8 points ahead. In 2008, when Obama swept in and the country gave him a filibuster-proof Senate, he only was ahead by 11, or they were, the Democrats were only ahead by 11% in the congressional races. So if they maintain this 11 to 12% in a midterm election, it will be unprecedented. An unprecedented defeat for the Republicans, and maybe substantial enough that all the gerrymandering that's taken place can be overcome and the Democrats can actually make some serious inroads.
Glenn Smith.
If I could, I'd like to ask Roy in a two-part question. So first of all, in that book that you're speaking of, in the sine wave in presidential elections, has the unexpected, has the occurrence of the unexpected been accelerating? That's one question. Have, in other words, has the pattern been broken more regularly than it was, say, up through World War II or up through the 50s?
Oh, you mean like since World War II, has the pattern been a little disrupted?
The pattern of, yeah, had the pattern of disruption of what you would expect. Because I want to say, like, Carter was unique, obviously, because of Watergate. Clearly, Obama was unique. And certainly Bush-Gore was unique since the Supreme Court actually decided that election.
Right.
I mean, I'm just wondering if we're seeing more disruption than stability in that pattern.
So actually Skowronek says this, and it, you know, I'm a Skowronekian, for what that's worth. So I choose...
thought so when I saw you walk in the door.
I want to ignore the part that, where he says this, but he does say that he thinks the pattern is breaking apart. And it pains me to admit that, you know, he has said that, because I really want him to be wrong about that. Because, you know, as it is, political scientists never predict the future. We're terrible at it. Usually we'll tell you what happened about 10 years after it happened. yeah. And so, you know, here's this one time we finally have something useful, and it may be falling apart. And I do see a lot of evidence that that's the case. I'm excited about Trump because he really looks to me like a disjunction. So he may be his own crisis, which is the exciting part. And so he may be restoring the cycle a little bit.
That's interesting. Well, that was going to be part two of my question. My fear about 2018 is that that pattern, which I'm not that familiar with it, but by your description, I think is reasonable and pretty justified. I'm afraid that, go back to what Thorne said, we actually are moving more towards a nervous breakdown of the democracy. that these things are getting, disruptions happening more and more and more often. If it was an individual we were talking about, and there was one instance of behavior that broke a pattern, and nothing bad happened for a year, and then there's another, and then quickly they were following week by week, we'd know what to call it, right? And I'm afraid that may be where we are, but you gave an answer to it. It is conceivable that Trump is so extreme, he sort of outrun the noise and let people, yeah. Right? He yeah. let people focus on the consequences of their inattention as this happened.
I really think that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good sign for 2018.
He may be, is it rapid cycling when you start to, if you're bipolar and you start to come apart? Like he may be helping us hit bottom. And
but will we have enough bounce back?
Yeah.
Or will we just sort of hang out there? The other question is, when you talk about the left and you talk about what's going to happen with the Democrats, one of the interesting things is not just, you were talking, Roy, about the congressional elections and presidential election, but what's happening on the municipal and state levels right now, and what's happened already, you know, what we saw in Virginia, what we saw in New Jersey, what we've seen and across the country, Democrats just doing exceptionally well, and a variety of Democrats in the center and Democrats way out on the left, have shown a lot of energy. And there's, you know, there are those who believe that what has to happen is that we have to take that the that the left of the party has to really show its strength on the local level, take over state legislatures, so that the redistricting can be affected, which is probably the most important single political phenomenon coming up in because that determines so much. You know, we're a democratic country.
Okay, so that's my fear. Well, first of all, we're barely a democratic country. I think we're officially a deeply flawed.
No, I meant Democrats.
Democracy.
I mean, there's more Democrats than there are Republicans in this country. No, whether we're democratic? No, I don't think we're very democratic.
Right. So, okay. So you brought up my big fear. My big fear is that the Democrats will do really well in 2018 and everybody will go back into their coma. 2020 will come along. Maybe the Democrats will win the presidency, but I actually kind of don't care. What I really care about is that the Democrats sweep the state legislatures in 2020. Yep. Like, if the Democrats don't capture either House of Congress in 2018, I'm okay with that, as long as they capture the states in 2020, or at least the governorships, so that at least they can veto the redistricting bills the Republicans are going to push through that create even more gerrymandering that we've
Okay, we're having so much fun that I'm letting the clock slip by. We do need to take another break. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio, and we're talking with Roy Casagrande and Glenn Smith. We're boogieing in here. We're boogieing. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio, and we're back.
A little James Brown does.
Yeah,
hurt.
We've almost solved all the problems of the world, yeah. But you know, it's an ongoing process. We're good, but my guests are Roy Casagrande and Glenn Smith, and we're talking of some politics. And there's really some politics to talk about. Glenn Smith, to remind everybody, is a noted Democratic strategist and is our regular political analyst here. He's the director of Progress Texas PAC, and he's a writer who's written for a number of publications. He has a column in the Quorum Report at this time. Roy Casagrande is a professor of government at Austin Community College, where he teaches U.S. and Texas politics and much more. So I want to thank everybody for being with us again. And now, gentlemen, do you think that you can each in one sort of succinct, because we can go off to a couple other topics, in one succinct comment, can kind of sum up what we've just learned? and do you think that we've concluded with some, you know, can have some wisdom thoughts?
The one that's like hanging questions that's laying out, it's like for either Glenn or for yourself, it's like, is that we have the Trump presidency and we have like the trends it's like in Republicanism right now, but do we have like anything to counter that in the way of policy, or does the I'm afraid to rely on just it's like, you know, these guys, it's like they're in power now are bad. Anything else would be better. Do we have like any inroads? It's like in seeing like a formation.
I mean,
like
does the other party stand for something?
Yeah.
I guess we could go there, but I want to in general sort of sum up what we've been talking about. Who wants to start?
Glenn, you want to go first?
Yeah. This was a wide ranging conversation.
It's
difficult to sum up. But
Do we think there's hope?
Oh, I definitely think there's hope. I want to look at some local developments to show you that where the voters are relative to what Trump's presence in the White House might indicate about where they are nationally. But look at the large numbers that Travis County voters passed county road bonds and school district bonds by 60% plus. Now, that's an overlooked little fact. Okay, great, they did it. But it doesn't always happen to such things, especially county bonds passed. And by such a margin shows me that people want to move forward, that people want the issues in their lives addressed by the people they put in government. It's not a time for retrenchment. It's a time for fixing stuff. And that gives me a lot of hope, because I think it's happening at least in urban areas all over the country. That's where the voters are. That's one of the reasons that the Republicans are trying to strip power from urban areas at the moment, but I don't think they'll succeed. So, yeah, there's hope even in 2018. I agree that Senate's hard to get. I think we'll probably come close to getting the House. I think at a minimum we're going to chastise Trump. I think we're going to scare the hell out of him if we don't beat him. And we can look for a little more, an earlier lame duck president than normal. I think the results of 18, even if we fall short, will make a lame duck of Trump. And it's hard to imagine him more lame than he already is, but I think he would be.
So we're using lame in multiple ways. It seems like the growth, you know, the direction that this country's going is in the urban areas. That's where, you know, I mean, that's kind of the future in terms of politics, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, let me say, when I want to answer Tracy's question as a part of this, because I think that on the left, it's time that we became strident, public, ongoing defenders of democracy itself to restore democracy. We're not defending the status quo. We actually want to bring it back. And I think we got to talk about such things as people think it's just the stuff for political scientists, but redistricting, voter suppression, courts deciding elections in willy-nilly ways, or the current Republican effort to undermine.
Like tossing a coin?
Right. I mean, I think we got to speak about these things and become like overt, out loud, singularly focused on restoring democracy to the nation. And so I think that's one place where Democrats can rally around and, you know, restore some visibility to a particular identity.
Okay. Roy.
Yeah, so you brought up an interesting point about the country is becoming increasingly more urban. The power is there. If you look at the counties that voted for Clinton and then compare them to counties that voted for Trump, in terms of population, they're pretty close, right? I mean, Clinton won, but not by a giant margin. Clinton's counties accounted for 65% of the GDP, and Trump's accounted for 35% of the GDP. So the disconnect that we're seeing on a national level ideologically between conservatives and liberals is also clearly an economic thing, where you have the super rich and the poor and backing the conservatives, and then you have the middle class and the upper middle class, although the upper middle class is divided, you know, backing the Democrats, and then the upper middle class is divided. But in any case, you asked the question about hope. And the answer that I have is, yeah, I have hope. I don't know when I've ever had this much hope, in fact. I think that the Trump presidency has brought so much chaos to the Republican Party that and it exposed these contradictions that there's a real chance. Having said that, I like what Glenn said about chaos not really serving the left very well. you know, in the past, that has really hurt, like, on a global level. My fear is that the loss of democracy in the United States isn't just in the United States, it's global. Since 2009, every year we lose more and more democracies. Poland looks like it's about to lose its voting rights in the EU because it's moved so far to the right and lost losing its democratic institutions. Hungary is not much further behind Poland. You know, so this seems to me also a global trend, not just a local trend. I would like to see the Democrats have a very serious actual platform: universal health care, free college tuition. I mean, like, just something that really differentiated it from the Democrats of say Clinton era, where it was, you know, Clinton was a conservative. He was just conservative light. He did the second wave on the war on drugs. He continued the process of deregulating the economy.
Welfare.
He got rid of welfare as we know it. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about a conservative. He was no liberal. And he wasn't, forget leftist, he wasn't even a liberal. So it would be really great to see an actual alternative to having two right-wing parties in the United States and be a little bit maybe more like Europe or Canada, where there's actually an alternative ideology.
Well, it's interesting that people who have campaign openly as socialists have won a number of races.
That's very true.
And that couldn't have happened until recently. And that has a lot to do, I think, with young people who don't have those old Red Scare kind of things burned into their brains.
Hey, Thorne, if I could I go back to something you said at the opening?
Sure.
I think it was about Mercer and quotes he made about the person that earns more money has more value as a human being. So can we turn that back on him and tell him that those counties with a higher GDP are twice as valuable as those?
That's a good point.
with a lower GDP, I just thought I'd get that out on the table while I could.
Yeah, he'd bring on Ayn Rand in as his defense lawyer, though, so I don't know. It's a great point. Great point. Okay, well, now we're down to about 6 minutes, 7 minutes. One thing about the world, I think this, what you brought up, Roy, is the question of the fact that there's global trends here that are also at play and that in a lot of ways are compatible with Donald Trump and the nationalism that he and the alt-right have promoted. And one question I have is this what was happening all the way, and has it just sort of helped the United States help develop that movement in the United States? Or, on the other hand, has Trump, by being who he is, given permission, a kind of permission to the rest of the world, if that makes sense?
No, I think we've definitely been trending in this direction even before Trump. I think Trump is a symptom. He's not the disease, right? People keep saying, I hope he gets impeached. I'm like, no, I want him to do the full 4-year sentence because, you know, he's going to feel like this was a prison term.
Force him through it.
Yeah, he needs to go the whole way. I think really the mistakes were in the 1950s when the United States decided it was going to become a semi-theocracy and, you know, switch our, why did we get rid of E Pluribus Unum? That was a great national saying, you know, we switched it over to God, in God we trust. Why? Who's God? Which God? And so the very fact that we've sort of, and then Reagan have sort of embodied this and embraced it and started talking about his relationship to God, although so did Jimmy Carter for that matter.
Jimmy Carter was a little more secular about it. He didn't, I don't think he pushed.
Because he did it in a Playboy interview or?
Well, not secular, but I mean, because he didn't necessarily want to make government involved in
but he did say that he was going to let his religion guide him in his decisions. Guide him personally. And then here's Reagan, God bless America. Yeah. And so I think Trump is the result of just decades of really bad decisions, but not just for the Republican Party, but the country as a whole.
What America means as an image more so than actual true values. And say, because he's a businessman, he's a tycoon, he seems successful. So it's like, that's supposed to be what we all want, right?
Yeah, but he's brought the idea of an autocrat, you know, into high relief.
I've always baffled when people say, I'm going to vote for that guy because he was a good business person. He's like, wait.
He was a terrible business person.
But government and business aren't the same thing anyway.
No, they're not.
Who wants a good business person?
Yeah,
government shouldn't be aiming to make a profit off of its,
of course,
its public.
Of course not. But if we want to judge a business by how many bankruptcy it has and how many people it refuses to pay, who is, you know, I mean, he's... You know, we even wonder how much money he actually has.
But I think that's one of the problems with the American ideology is that we think of ourselves as shareholders. So tax cuts coming, oh my God, it's like we just got a big distribution from our stocks instead of realizing that it's more like we're on a ship together. And if part of the ship is sinking, the whole ship is sinking. And so it's not okay to do tax cuts when it hurts the poor if you're looking at it from an ethical standpoint. Yeah.
I think a lot of it also had to do with this rabid hatred of Hillary. And I think a lot of people can come back now and say, oh, you know, we wanted this, and this that Trump promised, like the wall. But I think really from the people that I know who voted for Trump, it was a lot of let's hold your nose and vote at the polls for someone we don't really like because we hate Hillary that much.
Well,
and a lot of them were women.
Yeah, that's true. But on the other hand, Hillary ran a terrible campaign.
She ran a terrible campaign. She was a terrible politician and a terrible campaign. The Democrats were fools for running her.
Yeah.
Well,
so. Okay, Glenn.
Yes.
Well, we want you to come in because we've been saying such.
First of all, I agree with Roy. It's all totally up and down, pretty much on a wide perspective. I want to ask this question I've asked before, too, about the hatred of Hillary. I think I think it feeds back into something we haven't discussed today, which is Russian interference in the U.S. election in 2016. I watched.
That was on my list.
I watched that unfold. I'm going to be quick. I don't really know how much time. Unfold, you know, mid-election cycle of 16. Let me tell you, things like that don't happen unless they're made happen. And that almost overnight, singularly powerful hatred of Hillary came out of nowhere, especially among younger voters who knew nothing about her, had no reason. They may have been skeptical about this person they don't know. But that level of negativity and hate, I think, was driven in part by Russian bots.
Yeah. Oh, I agree.
You know, I don't, and I'm not sure.
I also
that
think
it'll last without their presence.
I also think there's a deep-seated misogyny that flows through American nations.
No question about that.
And that was coming to the surface too.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, that's something else we haven't talked about, which I want to mention here. That's the Me Too movement, and it's and the important sort of deeply, deeply cultural change that has to happen around it. Roy Moore's loss doesn't mean that this issue of harassment and assault is by any means lessened or gone away. No. A few high-profile men being popped, it's not going to make it going away. We got to dig deep and address it all as people, men and women, but especially men, better open their eyes and wake up and change. That said,
and it's real hard for it's. Go ahead.
That said, it is an extraordinarily powerful movement as we head into this election year because of the emotional power and the steadfastness and courage of those who are moving with it right now. It is sort of an anti-war movement of our time, and we need to pay attention to it, and we need to help it and assist it.
Okay, but of course we must realize that those who have privilege, and this is a very patriarchal society, those who have privilege, even if they're good people, don't give up that privilege very easily.
That's true.
Nope.
All right.
No, they don't.
Okay, well, we're right. Well, any final, like, well, we've got 30 seconds left, so I guess I want to thank everybody. This has been a lot of fun, and as we said before the show started, we said we knew we weren't going to get through all the things we wanted to talk about because we're all very talkative, for one thing, and because there's so much to talk about. So I want to thank you guys, Roy Casagrande and Glenn Smith, Susie Sheeler, Roger Baker, Tracy Schultz, and we'll be back next week with Bruce Melton. We're going to talk about climate change. We're going to look over the last year, climate change. Bruce is not only a former RAG blog writer, but also is kind of Truth Out's climate change guy. So, and has been our guest many times. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.